You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Malaysian government is saying, yeah, the plane crashed in the South Indian Ocean, and everybody's dead. And that's a very sad thing. And increasingly, the Indonesian government, or the Malaysian government, rather, is not saying this, but increasingly it's looking like something truly catastrophic happened in this airplane that probably had nothing to do with hijackers or terrorists or suicidal pilots. We do know that this particular airplane had those lithium-ion batteries in it that are relatively new and somewhat problematic that Boeing they were putting in their 787s. And actually, I can't say that we know this. I've seen news reports of this. I'm not on the inside here, so I've seen news reports of that. And those batteries, if they're charged or discharged excessively rapidly, they produce a lot of heat and they can burst into flames or produce smoke. There are some fairly elaborate electronic regulation systems that prevent them from doing that, but they could have failed. It's also not inconceivable that this was a very heavy plane with a long takeoff roll, and if the front tire was, and this is just my speculation as a pilot, I'm a private pilot, but I know how airplanes work. And we've actually seen this scenario happen several times, that if the front wheel was underinflated, and this is an airline that was experiencing a financial crisis, they might not have been at the top of their game with regard to maintenance. If that front wheel was underinflated, it could have caught on fire as the plane was taking off, and then they retract the gear up into the belly of the plane, and the nose wheel comes up underneath the cockpit, and that fire from that, you know, if that tire continued to be on fire, it could have been a problem. I mean, who knows? This is all speculation, but it certainly looks like this plane just flew on and on and on until it fell into the ocean, ran out of gas. And, you know, I hope for the sake of the people who were on it, just thinking, you know, if I myself was on that plane, that everybody got taken out by the poison gas 8 hours before the plane crashed, you know, because can you imagine? 8 hours of living, you know, flying terrorized. I mean, it's not inconceivable that the pilots were taken out by poison gas. And then nobody could break into the cockpit because the doors are now hardened to fly the plane. But I doubt that. I think flight attendants have to have a way to get in. There's got to be a way around that. If there is, they're not going to publicize it because then terrorists would know that they could threaten a flight attendant. But it's just logic, you know. So who knows? I don't know. But it's night now in that part of the world. And so, you know, today they found some debris. They dropped some flares. They dropped some buoys. The debris, of course, is, you know, 2 weeks plus old, almost 3 weeks old. So they've got to figure out where it floated from. Where did the current carry it to get back to the original crash site? And then, you know, drag a pinging buoy across there to see if they can find the black box, and this is still going to take some time. It took 2 years for them to get the black boxes on that Air France flight that went down off the coast of Brazil. So we'll see how this plays out. But anyhow, just to bring you up to date on that in a way that's not CNN-ocentric. Meanwhile, there are more than 60 scientists from around the world who are meeting this week in Japan. I don't know if you've seen this or read about it. It's a report that's being written at a meeting of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And there have been some leaks of the drafts of this. It's not finalized yet. But the leaks indicate that these guys are really freaked out that global climate change is not something we have to worry about in 2100, that it's happening right now, that it is producing famine and disease and war right now. And we do know, if you go back and look at the history of the Middle East, that what preceded the Tunisian overthrow of the government, the Egyptian overthrow of the government, the uprisings in Syria and in Libya, what preceded all of these was a failure of the wheat crop, which was the result of drought. The science is pretty solid now. The IPCC is saying that the drought and super, super hot that they had recently in Australia and in Moscow back 3 years ago, I think it was so far outside. It was such an outlier. It was so far out the outside of the statistical range of possibility that it was almost certainly caused by human activity. So, you know, basically what they're saying is we're seeing this now. And the potential for genuine catastrophic events is huge. And interestingly, their solution is to, at least so far in the draft reports, is to call for localized agriculture. Rodale has, you know, the organic gardening magazine folks, they've been, their institute has been sponsoring and doing some really fascinating research finding that when land is farmed using pesticides and herbicides, it basically sterilizes, it kills the soil. The soil just turns into clay. But when you use organic farming methods, not only do you get better quality food and healthier soil, but what fills that soil are living things, everything from fungi and bacteria to worms, and those living things are carbon-based life forms. In other words, you are sequestering carbon into the soil. And so by using factory farming methods, we are releasing carbon from the soil, and if we were to use organic farm methods, we would be sequestering carbon from the into the soil, which would be a good thing. And so they're saying, you know, maybe we should not have these giant agricultural companies and these giant, almost like the old Soviet farming methods, but instead go back to local and arguably organic agriculture. So, sounds like a good idea to me. I had an interesting conversation on Friday with Lawrence Wilkerson, the Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the assistant to Colin Powell. He very, very emphatically and aggressively, in fact, maybe I'll play a clip of this later on in the show, just came out and said that the guys in the Bush administration need to be tried for war crimes. Just very emphatically. And in addition, you know, I said, what's going on in the Ukraine? And he said, you know, the people are fed up. They want a clean, transparent government, and their government's been run by corrupt oligarchs. And he said the same thing's happening in Moscow, and the same thing's happening here in the United States. And it got me thinking, you know, when the Soviet Union fell, the Chicago boys went over there, just like they went down to Chile when we assassinated Salvador Allende. And Pinochet took power. And the Chicago boys drove the oligarchism of the Russian system. And the Chicago boys, you know, drove what was going on in Chile. And they've been driving for years and years what's going on in the United States. So we're seeing the rise of oligarchs here in the United States, like the Koch brothers. Oligarchs in Russia. Not so much in most of Europe, but it's happening slowly, certainly in the UK. Isn't it time to say this experiment, this libertarian experiment, has failed?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating piece in the New York Times today about the minimum wage. I got to tell you what they are teaching in private religious schools with your tax dollars. And welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. And Andrew Campbell, producer with The Big Picture, senior producer, actually, is on the line. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. The need to know, we're going to start out with Richard Wolff from our New York studio to talk about how it looks like Ukraine has signed up with the EU for a little bit of Greece.
Yeah, basically we all know what happened with Greece and what's happened across Europe with the devastating austerity measures that have been imposed by the EU before, and it now looks like history is going to repeat itself in Ukraine. And unfortunately, Ukraine, if this trade pact goes through, they're going to suffer through a very devastating period of austerity cuts. Their economy is going to be in turmoil, and that we'll really get the latest on it from Richard. And, I mean, really talk about why the EU is forcing Ukraine to do this. If they've seen the effects in other countries, why are they willing to repeat it?
Yeah, well, you know, the oligarchs of the EU make out very well, but we'll get into that tonight with Richard. In our Screwed segment, the Earth is going to cross the climate danger threshold.
Yeah, we're going to have climatologist Michael Mann on, who is really knows everything there is to know about climatology and climate change, so it should be a great interview. But there is a new report out that says that global temperature rise may have hit a plateau, and the climate crisis, as we know it, is going to be a lot sooner than we think. And interestingly enough, this corresponds with new information out from the IPCC, which is saying that the effects and dangers of climate change are coming a lot sooner than we all thought. So it'll be interesting to hear Michael's take on that.
Yeah, it's here now. And how Colorado disrupted the drug war.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to David Sirota. He's going to be live from Denver, and he wrote an interesting piece on Colorado's success with marijuana legalization and the parallels between that and how they've dealt with alcohol in that state, which a lot of supporters have pointed to as why the system was able to be put in place so quickly and why it's doing wonders. And we'll also tie that in with how families from across America are now moving to Colorado to try to get medical marijuana treatment for their children. And with that being the case, can more and more states look to Colorado and their success to implement new marijuana legalization policies?
Yeah. This is and he's also pushing back on a lot of the BS that's being put out there about what's going on. And then Fred Phelps' son is going to drop by, who was on our radio show last week. It'll be interesting, Nate Phelps. Interesting to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, of course. And Fred Phelps just passed away last week. He was the founder of the infamous Westboro Baptist Church, mostly known for their picketing of the funerals of soldiers across America and showing up at a variety of events with hateful signs and really ignorant things to say.
Yeah.
But they really attracted a lot of attention. But Fred's son, Nate, basically cut ties with his father many, many years ago. So it'll be interesting to learn more about why he cut ties with his father and the Westboro Church and what he thinks about the church's future now.
There's an interesting piece, I think it's over on Raw Story, about how Fred Phelps is a progressive hero. Maybe it's on Think Progress. In as much as his behavior caused such a strong reaction that it led to laws, it led to Supreme Court rulings, and in many ways it heightened visibility of the marriage rights movement and gay rights movements in ways that may not have happened if Fred Phelps hadn't been around. So
who would have thought?
Yeah, who would have thought? Andrew Campbell. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. This is some information that I did not know about. And it's quite fascinating. The piece is over on Alternet. Overwhelming evidence that half of America is in or near poverty. And the Congressional Research Service is apparently pointing out that the poverty line that we're using right now is, you know, it's inflation adjusted for, but based on living standards from the mid-1950s. And while inflation has gone up at a fairly steady rate, the costs of food relative to everything else have more than doubled since the 1950s. Housing has more than tripled. Reading from this quote, from this post, medical expenses are 6 times higher and college tuition is 11 times higher. I mean, other things have gone down, You know, computers didn't exist in the 1950s. The price of computers has been steadily dropping. And so, you know, these are one of the things that, keeps the pot, you know, where they index these things. But another amazing statistic, the bottom 47% of Americans, Mitt Romney's famous number, the bottom 47% of Americans own nothing. They are either in debt or they have no assets whatsoever. 47% of Americans. Almost half of Americans own nothing. The bottom 50%, so that would be, you know, 47 plus 3%. The bottom 50% just own a little over 1% of our nation's wealth, which is about almost $800 billion, which is the same amount owned by the richest 30 Americans. That's the bottom half of America. And it's far worse for black families. While America's total wealth has gone over the last 25 years from $12 to $77 trillion, the median net worth for black households has gone down. In those 25 years, when it started out, it was $7,150. This would be post Lyndon Johnson war on poverty. It was $7,000. Now it's $6,400. Half of the black children in the United States under age 6 live in poverty. So Paul Krugman has a fascinating op-ed in today's New York Times. It's titled Wealth Over Work. And he's basically, it's almost a book review of Thomas Piketty's new book, Capital in the 21st Century, which I ordered this morning. And Piketty is talking about what's called patrimonial capitalism. In other words, wealth that you didn't earn, but you inherited. And Krugman points out that the 10 richest Americans, 6 of them are heirs. They're not Bill Gates or Zuckerberg. It's, you know, it's presumably the Koch brothers and the Walton family. He doesn't identify them. I'm just guessing. But anyhow, 6 of them are heirs. And Piketty says the risk of a drift toward oligarchy is real and gives little reason for optimism. Oligarchy is where you've got a government as well as an economy run by a small group of oligarchs. I was talking in the last segment about, you know, the Russian oligarchs and the Ukrainian oligarchs. Well, here in the United States, we've got an oligarch problem. And George W. Bush made it a lot worse because when he came into office, the top income tax rate on dividends was the same as ordinary income. It was 39.6%. See, if people who have inherited wealth, they don't get paychecks. They get dividends. They invest that money and they get dividends. And so they were paying 39.6% income tax on that. George W. Bush dropped that to 15%. And the money that they got when they inherited money had a inheritance tax associated with it. George Bush dropped that to zero. And then Paul Ryan comes out with, you know, after the Republicans took the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan comes out with his so-called roadmap, his budget. And what does it do for people who are rich because they inherited it versus people who are rich because they earn a high income? Well, it leaves people who earn a high income with a top tax rate of 30-some-odd%. But people who are rich because they inherited it, Paul Ryan's plan would eliminate altogether any taxes for them, federal taxes, federal income taxes. No taxes on interest, no taxes on dividends, no taxes on capital gains, and no taxes on estates. So this is like, you know, if you want the landed gentry, if you want the country that we fought a revolutionary war to separate from, where you have a very, very small wealthy elite and the vast majority of the members of that wealthy elite are there because they were members of the Lucky Sperm Club, they were born into it. Paul Ryan is working to bring you that. The Republican Party is working to bring you that. In fact, Paul Krugman points out that, you know, the year before Reagan became president, 17% of all business income was taken in by the top 1% of households, the oligarchs. But you know, in the Bush years, by 2007, they weren't getting 17% of the business income. They were getting 43% of the business income and 75% of the capital gains. And who is it that the GOP passes all their legislation for? That top 1%. This is why when the Republicans talk to average voters, like down in Louisiana, it's all dog whistle racial stuff, because they know if they were to say, you know, yeah, you know, our real agenda is to make sure that people who inherit a lot of money end up in control of the political process. I don't think the average working person, even down in Louisiana, would vote for them. But when they say, hey, look out, black people are coming to get you, then the white working class in the South goes, we'll vote for Republicans.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Which is exactly why the billionaire's lackey, Paul Ryan, has to run around talking about inner city men who have no work ethic. Eight minutes before the hour here in the Tom Hartman Program, the place where despair is not an option, helping you win the water cooler wars. You know, I got an email from an old friend of mine in Atlanta with 20 jokes for intellectuals. I don't know where this came from. It's probably floating around the internet. I'm not going to lay all 20. Every now and then I'll drop one. But here's one. The number one. It's hard to explain puns to kleptomaniacs because they always take things literally. Okay. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia, listening on Sirius. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I come from West Virginia. What did God say to the West Virginians?
I don't know.
Stay here and look stupid. I'll get back to you.
Oh, geez.
Any rate, lithium batteries emit lithium hydride, lithium oxide, and another component of lithium. According to the material data sheet from OSHA, it causes you to be confused, go into a coma, and to die.
Right. So if the batteries on this plane were the source of a fire on this plane, they could have killed everybody on board.
And from what I've seen of these pilots, they were very highly trained. So if they were confused, then probably the first thing that would happen if there was an emergency, they would reach over and turn the locator knob on. Which, being confused, they might have turned it off.
Yeah.
They seem to be
Another possibility, Steve, is I don't know if you've ever been in a house when you've had a brownout. But I have, and there are different electrical devices. A brownout is when the voltage drops, but it doesn't go all the way to zero. It might go from 110 volts, you know, the normal 110 or 112. I think we're averaging around 113 here right now in Washington, D.C., where it goes down to 100, and then it goes down to 90, and it goes down to 80. And what I've seen is that different pieces of electronic equipment have a different threshold, different sensitivity, and I suspect it has to do with the wattage that they're pulling, how much amperes they need in order to function. But as that current drops, different things turn off at different thresholds. And so, you know, at 100 volts, you may still have 90% of your equipment operating. At 90 volts, you may only have, two-thirds of your equipment operating. And radios consume a fair amount of power relative to something that's just a display, because you've got to transmit a signal that is loud enough and strong enough to go hundreds of miles to a ground station. And so it may well be that nobody turned off the transponder, that if the batteries were on fire, as the power in that plane was dropping, as different cells in the battery ignited, that different pieces of electronics over a period of 10, 15 minutes turned themselves off, or just, you know, didn't have enough power to function properly. And so it looked like the pilots were turning things off in an orderly fashion. Does this make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
and of course,
go ahead.
And then of course, you've got, the other thing is that this lithium oxide is, like, this is in all of our hybrid cars. So you know, it's another issue where, you know, they should maybe use something safe. I don't know, like lead batteries.
Well, here's the and in fact, this the thing that makes me think even more about this is that Tesla had, I think it was three cars where the batteries overheated to the point where they were dangerous, which, you know, sounds like not very many, but their total production run, I think, was 30,000. So that's, you know, as a percentage, if that had been General Motors, that would have been thousands of cars. Now, they did solve the problem. It had to do with, as I recall, the regulators that determine how quickly the batteries are charging and discharging, not functioning properly. And so they put in, I guess, a secondary system, some kind of fail-safe system. But these lithium batteries, they're much lighter weight than lead batteries, and even lighter weight than nickel hydrate, whatever it is, the nickel batteries. Nickel cadmium. Thank you, Jim. And the NiCads. And they have much higher capacity. And so, you know, everybody's trying to figure out a way to use them. But, yeah, I'm with you, Steve. And lithium, in fact, lithium is a drug. I mean, you know, they give lithium to people who are schizophrenic, bipolar, who are, you know, going through manic phases, and it stones them. I've seen people on lithium. A friend of mine was manic, bipolar. It used to be called manic depressive. This was back when I was in my early 20s, and she was just, she'd go 4 days without sleeping, total mania, and then just, you know, crash in these horrible suicidal depressive states. They put her on lithium, and she started sleeping normally and acting relatively normally, except that she was constantly numbed and stoned. And so if lithium in the air has a similar effect, it would just, you know, progressively make you dumber and dumber until, like you said, you could pass out, you go into a coma, and then you die. So Steve, this is the top of my list of theories. Thanks a lot for the call. Tony in Henderson, North Carolina. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing today?
Good.
I urge the Democrat Party to come up with their own contract with America. I think they must get a vote or something to vote for. I thought back in the 90s when Newt Gingrich did it, you know, everybody thought it was something crazy, but you know what? He won.
Yep.
They won by the House. And I think it's the time for the Democrat Party to stop sitting around and worry about what Republicans want to kill Obamacare, because that's the only play they got in their bag right now. But I think the Democrat Party must get three things that they want to do, like a minimum wage bill, maybe unemployment benefits, maybe an immigration contract. These are three things they could put in the contract for America on the Democratic side and sell that to the American people.
Yeah, and I think if they added to that ending the drug war and ending our insane trade policies, they would pick up all the middle-of-the-road folks, the so-called independents, the libertarians. They could pick up a lot of voters. Rand Paul is going to be a serious problem in 2016, both for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And he might even become the Republican nominee. And if that's the case, it wouldn't surprise me if he actually became president. And I realize people might, you know, their eyes might be bugging out when I say that, but I mean this. And I agree with you. I think that the Democratic Party, by the way, there is no such thing as a Democrat Party. That was a phrase. It's the Democratic Party. It used to be called the Democratic Republicans, was the name Thomas Jefferson gave them. And in the 1830s, late 1820s, early 1830s, they dropped the word Republican from their name. And it's been the Democratic Party ever since. When Joe McCarthy started slurring them back in the 1950s, he dropped the IC from the name of the party and used to emphasize the RAT at the end. So you go, the Democrat Party. So it was like these rats. So just FYI, I know that your intentions are good, but I just wanted to tell you, you will hear, and thanks a lot for the call, Tony, you will hear Republicans constantly refer to it as the Democrat Party. There is no such thing as the Democrat Party. It never existed. It doesn't exist now. It's a slur. It's a slur that Republicans use. And it has been since the 1950s. But I'm with you. They really should come up with, and frankly, I think that they did in the progressive budget. And if the progressive caucus were to package the progressive budget as a contract with America kind of thing, here's 10 points. I think they get a whole lot farther. These guys are way too wonky. They need to have, you know, marketing 101. David in Arcata, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Tom, longtime fan, and I'm still Bertrand Russell in your chat room.
Oh, yeah, you've been listening for almost a decade, Dave. Thanks for calling. Oh,
probably, yeah, at least that. And I've got to say, an issue that's been traveling with me for a long time, I feel a need to discuss it as I often can, and that is, how in an honest democracy does a fraction of 1% that speaks only for the most greedy, rich, exploitative personalities, how do they end up getting 51% of our government? How can that happen? You know, I was getting an echo there, okay. But maybe you were trying to say something.
I was, but that's fine. You can finish your point.
Well, I think I'm making it. How does that happen? How can honest people go into a ballot and vote on an honest machine and have it come out that people that are only out to exploit the people get themselves in control of our government? How can that happen?
Okay, the way it can happen. First of all, I'm not sure that I always trust the machines, but setting that aside for the moment, I think it happens because the Supreme Court changed the rules of the game. I mean, if you were to say that in the Super Bowl, that when Denver's playing Seattle, that whenever Denver has the ball, the end zone or the goalposts, I'm not a football aficionado, I don't know how this is referred to, but the point at which you score the 0 yard line, that's actually the 20 yard line. And whenever Seattle has the ball, the 0 yard line, you got to go 10 yards beyond that. I mean, the Supreme Court has changed the rules of the game. They unleveled the playing field by saying that billionaires and corporations have rights under the 14th Amendment and corporations in particular, and that billionaires can use their money as if it was protected under the First Amendment as if it was speech. And because billionaires and corporations are almost always going to support the Republican Party, which exclusively reflects their interests, the Republican Party has this enormous electoral advantage. And that's why we need to amend the Constitution, which is the only way to get around the Supreme Court, to say that corporations are not people, money's not speech. Move to amend.org. Dave, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is the original cancer that corrupted our democracy. It started in 1886. It got really, really big in the 1970s with Buckley versus Vallejo, etc. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Gary in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Gary, you wanted to talk about lithium?
Yes, when I was back in school in California in the early 70s, we had one course where they indicated the people living around El Paso, Texas, had a much lower incidence of bipolar disease due to naturally occurring lithium salts in their water.
That's correct. And that's not the only spot in the world where they found that. And I don't know if this is one of the things that led to the use of lithium for bipolar disease or if this is one of the things that confirmed that it might be useful. But apparently lithium is one of those micronutrients that we do need in small quantities. But in large quantities, it causes stupor, and in very, very large quantities, it kills you. So.
I guess the best thing to do is study the limited amounts in the natural occurring water and see if maybe a drink or potion could be come up with that.
Yeah, I don't know how, and I don't know at what age. There's apparently a developmental piece to this too, that people need a certain amount of it, whether it's in utero or whether it's in childhood or whether it's in adolescence, in order not to grow up to have bipolar disorder, because once they have bipolar disorder, lithium doesn't make it go away. It merely treats it. And it's more of an anachronistic treatment now. It's not anywhere near as often, as frequently used as it used to be. But, good fertile areas for research, or maybe the research has been done and I just don't know about it. But, Gary, you're absolutely right about the epidemiology. Thank you for the call. Jeff in Nalehu, Hawaii. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Oh, a lot of things, Tom. I was awakened rather rudely by being attacked by Obama and his administration, using the CIA, the FBI, and my doctoring here, which has been oppressive for 20-some-odd years. About the antidepressants causing harm and calcification to the frontal lobes and stuff, such things. I got off those a while back. Now, my main problem was I had polio and great pain. It's called intractable.
Mm-hmm.
And I was denied medicine to lead a normal life with that. It's as important as diabetic insulin. Now, this whole thing came about because I came over here highly trained, had my head cleared out with psychoanalysis, could actually apply it and see way into the future. Now, that ties in with the problem we have now. We're not anticipating and we're not planning for the future we want.
Wait a minute. Are you suggesting that you can see the future, or are you simply saying that you have the logical ability to figure out that if we do 2 + 2, eventually we're going to have 4?
Yeah, that's the rational part of it.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff that comes in that is irrational is avoiding accidents that are foreseen.
Yeah.
Driving along a road at a particular spot, I was alerted. I told the driver of the car, and a week later, there indeed it happened. There are 9 cars, 10 cars coming on a two-lane road. And at the end, we had approached the first car. We were there. And the last car in the row was some nut going about 90 trying to pass everyone. Well, we were right there, closed off the corral. So had I not alerted my driver prior to that about a week before, we'd have got smacked.
Yeah, remarkable. Jeff, thanks for sharing your story with us, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Nalehu, Hawaii. Appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. However, does not lead to stiff thinking. Not to worry. Steve in River Forest, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was wondering if you knew anything about a lawsuit filed by Texaco against Toyota for attempting to use the battery technology for the EV1, which Texaco allegedly owns the patent for. And if that is the case, if they own this technology patent, which was partially funded by federal dollars, wouldn't somebody launch into an eminent domain lawsuit against them?
I don't know. I have heard over the years many stories about gasoline companies buying up everything from battery technologies to fuel injector technologies to carburetor technologies that will dramatically increase gas mileage or eliminate the need for gasoline, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's kind of in the public domain that Henry Ford and the early automobiles were typically powered by either alcohol or hemp-made diesel fuel, and John Rockefeller did his best to do away with that stuff, and thus we had gasoline or kerosene and gasoline. But that particular lawsuit, I don't know if that's something that you need to go to Snopes and see if it's been debunked or if it's true. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I wish you well. Check it out and let us know. Catherine in Indian Head, Pennsylvania. Hey, Catherine.
Hello. Okay.
You have a story about nonviolent civil disobedience and shale gas?
Yes, I do, Tom, but it's funny. I'm on the phone with a reporter right now.
Oh, you are? You want me to put you on hold and talk to you later?
Please do.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. So let's see here. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Bill Clinton cut capital gains?
96, after he got impeached in the House, he did all the dirty, filthy things that really screwed this country up. He cut the capital gains, him and that scumbag Gingrich.
I was going to say that, the president doesn't have the power to do these things. He can sign the legislation at the end, but it was...
He was promoting it. He was... Yeah. You know, him and Hillary aren't what you try to sell them to be. I don't know why you keep doing that. Arkansas is not progressive. It's down in the armpit of our country. It's not a good example of what can be with people that really care about the average person.
Yeah.
But I'd like to talk about something that's even more important that everybody omits and just...
You know, the alternatives to Bill Clinton, Armin, were George Bush Sr. and Bob Dole, as I recall. And
the game is fixed. You got to admit the game's fixed. It's a one party.
It's two parties, and one is wholly owned by corporate America, and the other's mostly owned by corporate America, and we can do something about that.
Let me tell you something to think about, Tom, please. This is very critical. This proves without a doubt that Washington has never been anything but a friggin' scam. Okay, since World War II, the Cold War and Korea and the skirmishes we got in Vietnam and the Cold War with Russia and everything, we've spent since World War II over $60 trillion with the T dollars.
Right.
Okay, the war on poverty since World War II and then Johnson, you know, the Great Society, has been $24 trillion. Okay, and the war on drugs has been $16 trillion. Okay, that's over $100 trillion. We're closer to war now than ever. We got more people living in poverty now than ever, and more people use drugs than ever. And here's the point. I can't make this point enough, and the people just don't get it. The point is money moves. Money parks. It sets somewhere in digits or in cash, and money retires debt. But money never goes away, and it never evaporates. Where is the over $100 trillion if it's not circulating in our economy, which it isn't? And the things that money buys may inflate, they may deflate, or they lose value or increase value, but the money that bought those things moves on. It never
Now, Armin, a lot of it is in the checking accounts of the people who benefited from the Cold War. I mean, here in Washington, D.C., there are suburbs around us. Thomas Frank was on my TV show about a year ago, and we were showing home movies, you know, where he went out with a video camera in a car until finally the local private police stopped him and threw him out, where he was driving through these neighborhoods where you've got these, you know, 30, 40, 50-room mansions with 30-room guest houses and, you know, like castles and moats and stuff, all, you know, in the rings surrounding Washington, D.C. We've got the richest zip code in the entire United States just outside Washington, D.C., and it's almost all defense contractors. It's like, you know, yeah, that money went someplace. It went to the top 1%. We've seen the biggest transfer, the biggest handoff of wealth in the history of the world since World War II from working people through the process of government to the top 1%. The war on drugs, absolutely. All that equipment for all those police departments, that's made by the military-industrial complex. There's drug testing kits. You've heard me rant about that. That's Big Pharma now. They bought up all the small drug testing companies. You know, it's Rick Scott down in Florida. You know, your guy down there. He, you know, biggest Medicare fraud in the history of the United States, and he's now your governor. I mean, this is where that money has gone, Armin, is it's accumulating in the hands of the top 1%, and they're using it to acquire political power and even become governors. So, anyhow, thanks for the call, Armin. Al in Rome, Wisconsin. Hey, Al, please be brief. We're right up against the end of the hour. The end of the hour.
Okay, I'll try. 2 weeks ago, there was a Senate hearing on the VA budget for 2014.
Right.
It turns out there's a hospital in, I believe, Eastern Washington. It's either Portland or Walla Walla. They're about to close their doors because they're not getting funded.
That's not good.
The ugly part of it is that the people from the VA didn't even know about this. They tried to disown the whole thing.
Huh. So who proposed closing it?
Nobody. They're just not getting the money.
Oh, is this part of the sequester?
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, because, you know, the sequester, I think, is hitting pretty much everything. This would be a question to put to Bernie on Friday, because he's the chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee. And anything that has to do with Veterans Affairs, Bernie Sanders increasingly knows all about. So, I'm hearing music. Is this is it? We're wrapping up. Okay, Al, thanks a lot for the call. I'm going to have to look into that a little bit more. Meanwhile, let me just commend to you "Wealth Over Work" by Paul Krugman today, and also Michael Reich and Ken Jacobs. This is also in the New York Times in the opinion pages. It's called "All Economics is Local." And they're basically talking about the minimum wage. It's a very thoughtful book.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. There's a fascinating piece in the New York Times on March 21st by Tanzina Vega titled, Students See Many Slights as Racial Microaggressions. And I've said many times, I think one of the most unrealized by white people aspects of white privilege is the privilege of never wondering if somebody did something because of your race. White people just don't generally have the experience of wondering, you know, did that guy just, you know, close that door in my face because of my race? Did he speak roughly to me because of my race? Or was it just that he had a fight with his wife? Did I get this seat in the restaurant? Because, you know, it just by and large doesn't even occur to white people, whereas people of color are confronted with this constantly and confronted with the question, what happened, constantly. And this, this is something that, I think most white people don't have any idea about this. And this article was talking about microaggressions, micro assaults, micro insults, micro invalidations, all the small ways that people of color feel slighted or abused, whether they're real or not. And in many cases, and probably in most cases, they actually are. And so I wanted to get on somebody to talk about this who knows more about it than I do. Rashad Robinson is with us. He's been on the program before. He's the executive director of Color of Change, colorofchange.org, a brilliant, extraordinary organization. And Rashad, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What are your thoughts on this?
You know, I think the article really does sort of capture, and this conversation that we're seeing, you know, popping up in both sort of universities, you know, in popular media, around the ways that race and perception and implicit bias sort of impact the ways that everyday people live. And sort of, you know, on one hand, we can be as a nation having these sort of conversations about, you know, about being post-racial and about race no longer mattering. While on the other hand, we see all the ways in which race can be a predetermining factor for so many sort of different issues in our society, from criminal justice to education to health disparities. And in the middle of that sits the ways that everyday people live, the way that you wake up each day and experience the world and how the world looks at you. And for, you know, these students who are speaking out on campuses, for folks who experience this in the workplace, these are very real issues that are not simply about public policy, but are about the larger ways that we live in this culture.
Yeah, and this isn't about the old racism of George Wallace. This is Joe Madison says, you know, Jim Crow has become James R. Crow, ESQ. You know, it's gone to a far more subtle level in some ways, and arguably perhaps even a more insidious one as a consequence of that. I don't know to what extent you feel comfortable sharing stories from your own life. But can you give our listeners and viewers some examples of these microaggressions, these micro-invalidations, micro-insults, micro-assaults?
Well, you know, I think one of the issues that became very prominent in national news and in media over the course of the last several years was the stop and frisk policies in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
And the ways in which Black and brown young people each and every day woke up living in a very different city than their white counterparts. you know, we saw stories of coaches, football coaches, telling their students to hold their helmets and wear their uniforms home from school so the police would see them as students and maybe leave them alone.
Students of color.
These are not the same experiences, right, that the same young white kids would have. That,
right.
That these type of day-to-day experiences, the ways in which folks, because of who they are, have to sort of code switch or change or sort of do different things to validate their existence and as a result ensure that they're able to move through the world, you know, is an impact of race, right? And you know, there are sort of public policy remedies in terms of how do we sort of monitor those in power, how do we keep data on how you know, folks are impacted by certain policies to make sure there's not disparities. But the day-to-day experience of these young kids in school, the young kids in New York City who are being stopped and frisked daily, you know, is sort of these day-to-day microaggressions that sends a very clear message about who you are in the world, what your value is, and that then informs how people grow up and experience the world.
And how sometimes, and some of them will internalize that, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely, it becomes, you know, it is sort of the training ground, the expectations that are sort of set for your future.
Yeah, we live up to the expectations of the people around us, or down to them, as the case may be, you know, which is another really, really nasty part of this. Is the experience, you know, I've had this conversation, you know, a number of times with people my age. Joe Madison is a friend. He's African American talk show host, and you know, we both grew up in a time back in the 50s and 60s when you know, America was very different than it is today in terms of racial diversity, racial participation, actual laws. Is the experience of racism as high impact on the young people today as it was on people of Joe and my generation? Just different?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm 35 years old, and
okay.
And I grew up sort of well after the civil rights, the kind of civil rights movement that really had a start and an ending, you know, through you know, Brown v. Board and through the marches.
Right, through the years when Joe and I were kids.
My life has been very different and really shaped by those experiences. But to the extent that the victories on the legal equality front have led a culture and a society to believe that the work is done, and that to talk about race, to bring race up, can make you the racist. To want to have these conversations means that you are sort of bringing up something that is passé and no longer relevant to these days and ages. You know, to the extent that like the problems of decades ago were in our face and had clear solutions, the problems that we currently face, the ways in which we still see huge disparities in terms of opportunity and equality and the ways in which people live in this world, but the solutions seem much more murkier. You know, the problems have just changed, and we are living in a world and a time and age where we still very much need a broad and bold coalition to both have these conversations and challenge status quo, but also put forward policies that will help us to be able to solve some of these problems long term.
Yeah, it's spot on. Particularly when you look at, I mean, black family wealth, for example, is down over the last 25 years, whereas white family wealth has gone up. So clearly, you know, where the rubber meets the road at the economic level, things have actually gotten worse. So, you know, we may not have segregated bathrooms, but there's still a long, long way to go. Rashad Robinson, Executive Director, Color of Change, colorofchange.org is the website. Rashad, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Travis.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, have you experienced or been perceived as being the perpetrator of microaggressions? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Debbie in San Jose, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Debbie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I think that it's time now, for the sake of humanity, indeed for our very existence, for a global revolution, an entire restructuring of our economic system from the current profit-based capitalist system to a, you know, a human need, sustainable-based socialist system. And when I say socialism, I mean real socialism, not the Stalinism or Pavlovism that we've seen in Cuba and Russia and, you know, where it's a single country. It would have to be global, and it would have to come from a revolution of the working class. And, you know, all of our social cultural ills would be eliminated. Racism, inequality, poverty. I mean, not right away, of course, but, you know, everything, all of our ills fall under capitalism and the whole profit-based motive. It just leads to corruption and greed.
It all goes back to money.
You know, excuse me?
It all goes back to money at the end of the day. It's,
yes,
it,
yes.
It all goes back to
money. It's the root of all evil.
Yeah. Or the love of money is the root of all evil. Absolutely,
yeah.
Debbie, excellent point, and I can't disagree with it. Thank you very much for the call, Catherine in Indian Head, Pennsylvania. You were on a little earlier, Catherine. Did you not get your story told?
Oh, I was actually on the phone with a reporter about another event.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Thank you. Yes. I'm sorry. Go. So now you're on with me. What's up?
Oh, so last week was this great week-long event called Sheffield Justice Spring Break,
mm-hmm.
which is modeled off of a program called Mountain Justice Spring, which is an alternative spring break opportunity for college students to come to frontline communities and learn about extractive industries and how they are absolutely destroying our landscape, ruining lives and air and water. So, on Thursday, there was a nonviolent direct action that kind of arose out of this week that involved three Pennsylvania residents securing themselves to about 12 feet of cement pipe and blocking a public road, which was an access site, which was an access road for a Marcellus drilling company called Anadarko for one of their well pads on state forest land in the Tyodotten State Forest.
People end up in jail?
Five did,
yeah.
Which I'm pretty proud that it was only five people who were in jail because I was acting as police liaison.
Mm-hmm. Good on you.
Pardon?
I said good on you.
Yes, there were about 20 folks at the scene initially who were participating, and those who were not locked down did choose to leave of their own free will, minus two folks who were acting as direct support, who didn't end up also being arrested. And this is a pretty big deal. These folks, they were all young adults who chose to sacrifice their freedom to protect our sacred lands and protect our air and water.
Catherine, is there a website about this that we can direct people to?
Yes, there is. It's MarcellusShaleEarthFirst.org.
How do you spell Marcellus?
MarcellusShaleEarthFirst.
Okay.
SHaleEarthFirst.org.
Okay. Catherine, thank you very much. I'll have to check it out. Sophie, Sophie, don't die. The last words of Archduke Ferdinand, speaking to his wife, who had been shot before him, and she was dead, by Gavrilo Princip in Sarajevo in 1914, and thus began World War I. Could something like that happen again? Could it begin World War III? I don't know. Interesting. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, you wanted to talk about race?
Yes. I wanted to ask the question with regard, I'm sorry, I'm a little discombobulated, but yes, I wanted to address the issue of race in terms of the way it's become much more nuanced. And to what extent are we being intellectually dishonest when we talk about disparities in race and racism, while at the same time talking about all of the, shall we say, the differences in terms of access to good education, good prenatal care, nutrition, all of the things that we will say have an impact on one's life down the road as an adult.
Right.
And then at the same
actually
time,
just
say,
family wealth to begin with. You know, the average white family in America has got 80 grand. Right. The average black family has seven.
Right, exactly. Now, where are we, you know, creating a sort of intellectual disconnect when we say all these things are manifestly true, and yet at the same time we say, oh, by the way, it's not fair to conclude that there's any differences when it comes to people who are qualified, people who are more likely to commit crime, or again, better suited for a particular career, and this sort of thing. You know, are we arguing out of both sides?
Well, I don't think anybody's asserting that. I think that the lack of people who are people of color who are qualified in some fields is a consequence of that, of 500 years of institutionalized racism. Not to mention, you know,
right,
an entire people being
right,
ripped apart from their past. Most white Americans know their own ancestry and have the ability to, through genealogical records, to track themselves back to Europe and back hundreds of years. Most African Americans don't have that. I mean, I think we underestimate the impact of that at our peril.
Well, and I think that's absolutely correct. But again, I mean, to my point, can we argue that all of these things which are denied to African Americans, in addition to what you just raised, and then assert that there isn't some sort of disparity in terms of all sorts of issues?
Well, now you're making the Charles Murray bell curve argument. The fact of the matter is,
I'm making the argument that is the logical extension of the one that's even made among.
No, I know, and Murray would say that he was not making that based on genetics. He was making that based on all these factors that you're describing. And in that context, I think that you can make that case. But the point is that it's a bell curve. It's not a line. That there are, you know, even in the face of horrific circumstances, you are going to have people who are going to be outliers in both directions off the curve.
Absolutely.
Whether it's Condi Rice and Clarence Thomas and Thurgood Marshall on the one side, or whether it's, you know, the guy who's a career criminal on the other side, that you're going to have that curve for every race, and there's going to be all these external variables that are going to shift that curve, but there's always going to be people who are the outliers. And the danger is when we say, oh, look at Condi Rice, look at Clarence Thomas, look at Thurgood Marshall, our work is done.
No, and yes, and that's absolutely true. And by the same token, then, you know, you've got to, rather than looking at individuals, you've got to continue to look at group dynamics and look at the totality of the African-American experience in this country.
Right.
And again, look at millions of African-Americans, not the one that you can point to, just like saying, you know, I mean, you know, buy lottery tickets. Why? Because I know a lottery winner, they're set for life. Well, that's cute, but, you know, hardly to the point in terms of, rationalizing buying lottery tickets as a retirement plan.
Right.
But
to my point, I mean, I'm seeing I live in D.C. It's a relatively integrated city, or it's about 50-50 white and black. I don't want to say it's relatively integrated, because the only integrated neighborhoods that I've been in are ones that are rapidly being gentrified, where whites are moving in, blacks are moving out, the property values are going up, people are being driven out by the tax base. But I've gotten to know people who are black, and I work with people who are black, and it seems that the opportunity for the perception of, you know, why did he not hold the elevator door for me, or why did he, for that matter, you know, is he patting me on the head? Those kind of slights, there's a lot of literature right now. There was a great piece over an alternate yesterday about people who are basically intentionally, people of color who are intentionally resegregating themselves so that they don't have to deal with, you know, asking the question, did that person just do that because of my race?
Right, exactly.
And it's like, this is...
And there's a lot of literature which questions that because, you know, there is this reality in terms of wealth disparity, population disparity. Like it or not, in this country, you can be born white, middle class and above, and you can live your life without ever being closely associated with an African-American, go to college and do so.
And that's the experience of about half of whites in this country.
Right, exactly. Now, you cannot do that, unfortunately, as an African-American, just like you can't say, you know, if I'm Irish, I'm going to solely associate and go to school with other Irish people,
right,
like, sort of thing. And it's just not a policy that in the long run is going to be very successful. And it's not fair. You know, again, you can do that as a white person by and large in this country. You can't do it as an African American and hope, you know, to go.
Right. So the question then becomes, Steve, how do we move beyond that? And it seems to me that it's going to take something. I think that affirmative action was a beginning. It when people are on an equal economic and social level, then they don't start asking those questions. And as long as that inequality persists, those questions will be there. But how to get there, I don't know. Steve, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's more than 40 acres and a mule, but that would be a damn good start. We'll be back. The bad of the very, very minyardly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, Edward Shoemaker Matos. NPR's ombudsman says that news outlet should stop using the name of Washington, D.C.'s NFL team. He says that the team's name, the Redskins, quote, should be avoided in web headlines and used only infrequently in stories. Some news stories, not all, should note the name dispute in passing. The idea, Shoemaker Matos added, is, quote, to encourage a public debate, allow Native Americans to be fully heard, and see what social consensus emerges. There's no question, in my opinion, that it's time for Washington's NFL team to change its offensive and racist nickname. And while using that nickname is sometimes unavoidable in the news business, it's important that we listen to what Native Americans think about the issue. If they think the name is offensive, then we probably shouldn't use it. And maybe, just maybe, by refusing to use the name of Washington's NFL team, we'll get the team's owner, Dan Snyder, to change it. The bad. The Egyptian government. Earlier this morning, an Egyptian court sentenced to death 529 Muslim Brotherhood supporters of deposed President Mohamed Morsi. The defendants are accused of inciting violence toward police officers during an August protest against the July 3, 2013 coup that overthrew Morsi. Although their sentences will likely be overturned on appeal, the fact that over 500 people could be executed for really doing nothing more than supporting a democratically elected president should scare anyone concerned with the future of Egypt. When Egyptians first gathered in Tahrir Square in Cairo more than three years ago, they demanded an end to the arbitrary and frankly authoritarian policies of the Mubarak military regime. Now it looks like that military regime has returned with a vengeance. Democracy in Egypt looks as far away as ever. And the very, very ugly Pat Robertson. During a recent episode of the 700 Club, Pat Televangelist said that one of his viewers' co-workers was an atheist because she had been raped. Seriously. Check it out.
I don't know if you're dealing with something that is demonic or something that's deeply ingrained, but I mean, to be that openly hostile to the word God, something beyond normal human experience. Yeah. Something has happened, and she associates God. Maybe she had an abusive father, somebody who raped her.
It's just totally bizarre and very, very. Pat Robertson, yeah, he gets way too much press. Tanisha in Seattle. Hey, Tanisha. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm fine.
I look at you. I watch you every day.
Thank you.
And I just have a couple comments. One of the comments that I wanted to speak upon was race.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not, we were not brought here as black people to be citizens. We were brought here to be slaves.
Right.
And that's a part, and that's a part of it. We were taken from, I mean, we were separated from the beginning. And that's a lot of what you see today, of us being separated from each other. Also, it's more or less like nothing has changed. I mean, you can bring out civil rights and this, that, and the other, but when it comes down to it, nothing has really changed. Us as black people, when we drive down the street, we could be bopping our heads, but when we see a police officer, we sit up straight. We drive straight. We don't want to give any indication that we're doing anything wrong, because that's the perception that we have.
Right.
I also wanted to bring up this. As far as, like, drug dealers, they say drug dealers, people who have been convicted of selling crack cocaine or methamphetamines or whatnot, it brings a thought to mind that you see all these drug companies on television selling like these Lipitors and these Cialis's and all whatnot, Viagras, and they'll tell you the side effects of it on how you'll have suicidal thoughts or vomiting or maybe even death. But it's legal, but it's not FDA approved. So I don't understand what's the difference between something that you put out there like that than crack cocaine.
Well,
yeah, crack dealers are in jail. I mean, I'm not trying to decipher the fact about being cocaine, but what I'm saying is that crack cocaine is a generic. There's things that you add into it in order for it to become crack, which is also what they add into different things that are not FDA approved.
Well, first of all, Tanisha, right? I get your point, and I think that it's a really important one that first of all, the war on drugs is crazy. Secondly, if you've got people in communities where there are no economic opportunities, the entrepreneurial spirit is very real, regardless of race or upbringing. And
hello?
Yeah, can you hear me? Tanisha, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, cool. I think the entrepreneurial spirit is very real, and I think, you know, people are going to figure out a way to make a living and start a business. And if they're starting that business selling crack, you know, that or pot or anything else, you know, that's hey, it's a business that we have to, as a society, decide what businesses we want to allow and what ones we don't. I think the war on drugs has been a giant failure, but that's kind of a side argument. The drugs that you see advertised on television are FDA approved. However, it used to be it was against the law to market directly to consumers on television. It used to, or in any other way. And now they're marketing directly to consumers. And so you've got a lot of people asking for these drugs who really shouldn't be on them and really don't need them. And you've got doctors who feel pressure to prescribe them. And the pharmaceutical industry is making a fortune. And it's not a good thing for public health. It's not a good thing for America. And I don't think we can draw a direct parallel between that and crack. I'd say, though, that you've got the pharmaceutical industry, you got a bunch of largely white guys in multimillionaire white guys in suits who are responsible for the deaths of a lot more people. And Mike Papantonio makes a living prosecuting these guys. He speaks to that on this program. They're responsible for a lot more deaths than all the quote illegal drug dealers end quote in the United States combined. And that's something that we don't talk about. Is that the point that you were making?
Somewhat. And also that I consider to be like prisons and whatnot. So I consider that to be new age slavery.
Yeah.
I mean, because the more black men that are subjected to that, I mean, that are thrown into that equation. Okay, you say that it comes from taxpayers. We pay for these people being in prison, all this whatnot. But then you have corporations that own prisons.
Yep.
That are only paying prisoners maybe 35 to 65 cents a day.
Right, and they run manufacturing operations out of those prisons, I'm with you. And not only that, but once those people leave that prison for the rest of their lives, they're going to have to check that little box that says, "Yes, I was arrested, I was a prisoner," and that's going to consign them to a lifetime of lower pay and fewer job opportunities, which takes us back to your assertion that it's a form of slavery. It's not the slavery of the 19th century. But it is certainly a diminished place in the workplace.
I can't even use my skills that I get in prison outside of prison.
Right.
In other words, I learn a trade while I'm here, but then I get out, and I can't even get a job with the trade that I've learned that I've gone through this so-called rehabilitation in prison.
Right.
And there's no mark for rehabilitation because that's not really what they want. Philadelphia has one of the most overcrowded prisons that has ever been in our history since 1970. And it's inhumane and it's wrong. You have prisoners that are being put with prisoners that are doing murder, I mean, in life for murder, and you're putting them in with drug dealers who are non-violent criminals.
Right. And who are entrepreneurs.
Okay, well, let's rehabilitate you. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. Tanisha, thank you for calling and sharing that. It's very well thought out. Thank you. Walter in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Walter, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up? You want to talk about money and politics?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an idea to get money out of congressional politics. I have an idea that would make the money powerless.
Okay.
I suggest a constitutional amendment that makes every seat in Congress permanent.
Well, wouldn't then people just spend that much more money to get that seat in the first place?
But once they do, they aren't obligated to anybody because nobody can take the seat away from them.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's the theory of the Supreme Court. And it hasn't worked out all that well. I mean, you've still got now Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia going to the Koch brothers retreats and hanging out with fat cats. And I think people can still be corrupted, even if you can't corrupt them on the basis of losing their job.
Well, but the thing is, we wouldn't need 535 angels. We only need 229 people who are reasonable and can talk to each other and reach a compromise and pass legislation.
Well, here's a good way to analyze the wisdom of your argument. And I'm not saying it's not a smart argument. It may well be. This is a debate that the founders had, and they decided that one body of Congress would be elected every 2 years, and another body of Congress would be elected every 6 years. And the body that would be elected every 6 years, it would be a six-year election, so they would be less subject to pressure from the people and thus freer to follow their conscience. And so the question you have to ask is, has the Senate become the more high-minded, conscience-filled body as a consequence of that? I would argue probably not.
Now, the Senate was not initially elected.
You're correct. It was appointed.
When the founders founded the original country, they founded a country that was owned and operated by white men.
Right.
And they set up the election process so that they can control who voted, so they can control who got elected, so they can control what those elected people would do.
Yeah, largely at the state level, but yes.
The reason I suggest this is because constantly hear members of Congress on the television saying, if it
wasn't... You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You've got 10 seconds to finish your sentence.
If you separate them from the need to please the money, they can vote their conscience.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, what do you get when you cross a joke with a rhetorical question? Yeah. Oh, well. Thank you. Dave in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching Free Speech TV, which, by the way, is in their fundraising drive. And so if you are watching Free Speech TV, please call them at 877-378-8669 and make a donation. Dave, what's up?
The check is in the mail.
Good on you.
Tom, did you see Harry Reid on C-SPAN excoriating the Koch brothers?
I did.
Not once, but twice.
Last week, yeah.
Oh, you did catch it?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I don't think we played the audio on the show, but I talked about it on this show, yes.
It's terrific.
Yeah, yeah. Harry.
And, it's about time.
Yeah, Harry has found his inner boxer.
Yeah, he's found the boxer in him. And I hope that he starts a trend and the Democrats get a little bit of unanimity in this message, because I think that's a winning message.
They're doing it. They're doing it, Dave. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, the DSCC, has come up with an ad buy, and you can probably find this fairly easily with just that information in the search engine over at YouTube. They've come up with an ad buy, or on DuckDuckGo.com or one of the other search engines. They've come up with an ad buy where they're producing ads where they're literally calling out the Koch brothers in five or six states saying, you know, like they've got this ad from this woman saying, you know, I don't like Obamacare, you know, whatever. And they say, this is a New York actress. You know, why is she being run on the air here in Alaska against Mark Begich? Well, the reason why is because these billionaire they don't name them, but they show a picture of them. Out-of-state billionaires are funding this campaign. And the insurance companies are getting rich off your suffering. And, I mean, these are really, really hard-hitting ads. And I think that they're going to work. I agree with you. I hope that the Democrats can hang on to that.
You think they'll carry it over into the national election?
Well, these are for national. This is not for the presidential election 2016. These are for the midterms of 2014. But, yeah, I think so. I think once they figure it out that it works, they're going to go for it. And also having an enemy helps. And identifying the Koch brothers as an enemy. And I think that, you know, for many Americans, they don't want you to have health insurance. That's not a friend. So we'll see where it goes. Anyway, Dave, thank you for the call. June in Shawano, Wisconsin. Hey, June.
Hi, Tom. This morning I heard something that really scared me. They are planning to ship tar sand oil across Lake Superior.
Oh, my.
To begin in 4:15. And this is very dangerous because Lake Superior has very rough springs.
Yeah.
In addition, they have no plan for any kind of spill.
Right.
This isn't going to be shipped by tanker. This is being done by barges.
Wow.
And this is all part of the Enbridge people who are responsible for the Kalamazoo River spill.
Amazing. June, thanks for the heads up on that. I'll have to track it down. Anybody who doesn't know what June is talking about, just look up the Edmund Fitzgerald and what happened there. This was a mining ship that went down back in the day. June, thank you so much for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Mark and Carl and Brittany and Joan and Corky and Pat. Please hang on the line. We will get to your calls at the beginning of the next hour, as we go into the next hour. But right now, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. And right now, I should say, but hi, Victoria.
Hi, Tom.
Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. So what's going on in the world today?
President Obama is in The Hague in the Netherlands today. He's on a 5-day overseas trip. He's at a nuclear security summit, and on the sidelines of that trip, there was a meeting of the G7. It's the G7 because Russia was not invited.
So the G8 has become the G7 because of Ukraine? Or?
Well, effectively it has, because as they came out of the meeting, there was a statement put out saying that the G7 summit will be in Brussels in June, not in Russia, and so Russia is disinvited. They called the Crimea referendum illegal. They condemned Russia's annexation of Crimea. They vowed significant consequences. They have refused to recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea, and the leaders vowed to adopt additional sanctions on Russia.
Remarkable. Originally, this was going to be a G8 meeting in Sochi, wasn't it?
It was going to be a G8 meeting in Sochi in June. That's correct. And that will be a G7 meeting in Brussels.
Wow.
Now, also on the sidelines of the nuclear summit meeting, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met his Ukrainian counterpart today and urged constitutional reforms to protect Russian speakers in the country. That's the highest level meeting between Russia and Ukraine since the ouster of its Russian-friendly president. Lavrov also met with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on the sidelines and urged Kerry and the Ukrainian acting foreign minister that Ukraine needs to reform its constitution to end the country's crisis. Now, Lavrov didn't directly respond to a question on whether or not Russia can be trusted not to launch a military incursion into eastern Ukraine. He said, "We're not forcing anyone to believe us. We, for a long time, believed our Western partners, starting with the collapse of the Soviet Union, when all kinds of spoken and written promises were made."
Hmm. What I don't get the end game here. If Crimea is now part of Russia, and the Russians are not going to give it up, and the Crimeans are not going to embrace Ukraine, and I think that that's pretty much settled reality.
Right.
Why would the G7 want to separate themselves from Russia when Russia can be so helpful with a whole wide variety of things? Starting out, they provide 30% of the gas that Europe uses, which is, you know, six of the other seven countries, or actually five of the other seven countries, I guess. And secondly, Iran, Syria. I mean, there's all these things where we have been, ending the nuclear arms race, disposing of loose nukes. There's all this stuff where we have been collaborative with Russia that really should continue. And how does estranging ourselves progressively from Russia over something that they're not going to change? Is this just to say, be careful, don't go any farther, it just seems to be counterproductive.
I think that the goal is to both to punish and to say don't go any further. I think it's a combination of the two. I think they do want to continue working on Syria and Iran, and I think that the relationship, for example, between Lavrov and Kerry, which is a very long one, is hopefully good enough that they will be able to continue to do that.
But isn't there you throw kids out of school and then you tell them you got to go to school, pretty soon they stop showing up at school. I mean, isn't ostracizing Russia increasing the probability that they're going to separate?
There is that argument.
Huh. Okay. All right.
There is that argument.
What else is up?
The Malaysian Prime Minister announced today and apparently informed the relatives of Malaysian Airlines MH370 by text that the plane crashed thousands of miles away in the southern Indian Ocean.
Right.
All 230 people on board were presumed dead.
Right.
Relatives react with shock and horror. Many had to be taken out of rooms on stretchers. Some people banged the walls. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. He said that the UK Air Accidents Investigation Branch told him that Inmarsat, the UK company that provided the satellite data, which indicated the northern and southern corridors, has been performing further calculations on the data and using a type of analysis never before used in an investigation of this sort. They've been able to figure out that MH370 flew along the southern corridor and that its last position was in the middle of the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
They'll have more information.
You know, the explanation of all this that makes the most sense to me is that something caught on fire, whether it was the front tire in the wheel well or whether it was those lithium ion newfangled batteries that they had on this plane, which do produce smoke, which does cause delirium followed by coma followed by death in fairly rapid order. Is anybody saying that out loud, or is everybody afraid of incurring the wrath of Boeing?
No, that is one of the theories, that something caused the pilots to pass out and that it became effectively a ghost plane. That is one of the theories.
Yeah. Let's hope that that's what happened, because any other scenario, 8 hours of terror is just,
it's too dreadful, too dreadful
to contemplate.
Wednesday, Democratic leaders will put forth a discharge petition in the House.
To bring back unemployment insurance?
No, on immigration reform.
Oh, interesting. What happened to the discharge petition on unemployment?
I don't know. I don't think that they put it forward.
They didn't get enough votes?
I don't think so. They don't expect to get enough votes on this either.
Yeah.
But they hope that it will prod them.
Yeah, because it would have taken 15 or 20 Republicans, somewhere between those two numbers, Republicans, in order for either one of them to get enough votes to be a successful discharge petition.
And they've got 200 Democrats on this, and they think they've got 3 or 4 Republicans, but it's not enough.
Yeah, remarkable. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with me, Shane Bauer, Sarah Schwerd, and Josh Fatal. They are the collective authors of a new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And they are the, if you remember back in 2009, the three hikers who got nailed on the Iranian border. Actually, a guard said, come over here, and you didn't realize you were, Josh, stepping over the border.
No, we didn't realize.
We were stepping off the border or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we were unfortunately walking along the border. Guard pulled, waved us to come, and we, at that point, crossed the border.
Yeah.
And then from that point, it was downhill from there. We went down the hill into Iran. They took us down into SUV, and a guard, and the police at the police station, immediately somebody sees that we're American and says, you're American. You know, the Americans just took people, Iranians hostage, prisoners for 2 years. 2 years. And I thought, well, that's between these governments. That shouldn't have anything to do with me. But, of course, that was just the first few hours of 781 days.
Wow. Yeah. And a lot of it, at least for Sarah in particular, in solitary confinement, all you guys were also held under those conditions. And first of all, let me introduce Shane and Bauer and Sarah Schwerd. And hi to you guys. I got to look around the camera here to see Sarah. And they're sitting in our studio over by Shano, our board op and associate producer. Sarah, first of all, if I could start with you. You speak compellingly about the impact of solitary confinement, and you experienced a lot of this. Talk to that, if you could, please.
Well, prolonged time in isolation really slows down the human brain. After 2 to 3 days, studies have shown that the brainwaves will shift towards stupor or delirium. And I spent 410 days in solitary confinement. The UN says 15 days can cause permanent lasting damage and constitute torture. You get reduced to an animal-like state, pacing your cell compulsively, obsessively. People that I've known in this country that have been in solitary for years or decades will actually wear a path into the concrete floor of their cells from pacing.
Wow.
You're filled with anxiety. It's hard to sleep. At the worst moments, I completely lost awareness of myself and screamed and beat at the walls of my cell.
Yeah, in one case, without even realizing you were doing it.
I thought the scream was coming from far away, another corridor, and I just wanted it to stop because I couldn't do anything to help that person. I just wanted it to go away. And then the guards burst into my cell and started shaking me, and I realized I'd been screaming.
How does that affect you now?
I'm doing well now. I've had incredible support from family and friends. Shane and I have really helped each other through this. A lot of people don't have that support when they get out. Many people are released in this country directly from years in isolation onto the streets with no networks, and it's not surprising that they often go back to crime and end up back in prison, or they end up homeless in the street. These days I don't have many lasting symptoms, but it took years.
Yeah, Shane, the three of you have become pretty outspoken advocates for ending the use of solitary confinement as a punishment tool in United States prisons. Tell me about that.
And in my work as a journalist, I've kind of, after I got out of prison, I went from my focus in the Middle East to kind of looking in prisons in the U.S. I heard about a big hunger strike that was happening in California. It was involving thousands of inmates that were protesting long-term solitary confinement, and I found that there were people in California that had been in solitary for 20, 30, 40 years. Some of them, you know, who were there because they were named kind of gang members or gang affiliates. And when I dug into their cases, I found people that, you know, were called gang affiliates because they had books, academic books by the Black Panthers, Machiavelli's Art of War, or they had, you know, spoken to a gang member at some point, and they would get in, put in solitary in cells that I visited that were 7 feet by 11 feet, had no windows, and it was really hard for them to get out. You know, once they got in, it was hard to get out. And we're talking about 80,000 people in the country that are in solitary confinement, more than any other country in the world.
Josh, are the solitary conditions in the United States worse than they were in Iran?
Now, it's hard for me to compare. I've not been in the solitary cells in the U.S., but I do know the U.N. considers 15 days in solitary to be torture. And the idea of being left alone in a cell with no one to talk to, one of the things I would realize and told myself again and again in prison was people are people through other people.
Right.
And that's something that Nelson Mandela has said and he writes about. And it's really
true. Social animals.
We're social animals. And when you have no one to talk to, you just you lose sense of who you are.
Right.
And so whether you're locked in a 10x14 cell in Iran or a different cell in the U.S., it's solitary confinement.
Right. Or an animal in a zoo, for that matter. I mean, it's you see these animals in zoos who behave so
frantically.
Not normally.
Yeah.
What are you guys doing? Sarah, what are you doing to try to stop, and what success are you having to bring awareness to and try to stop the use of solitary confinement in the United States?
I'm a contributing editor at Solitary Watch. You can find us at solitarywatch.com. And over the last 6 or 8 months, I've been collecting written and oral testimonies from people around this country in prolonged solitary confinement through in-depth letter correspondences, prison visits, and in-person interviews for those that are on the outside. And we'll be compiling these into an anthology, writing by people in solitary. And I'm also writing a play called Opening the Box. So really trying to bring America's attention to the fact that this practice destroys people. It breaks them. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that go into the prison system have already had really difficult lives. You know, they've made mistakes, but that doesn't mean that they deserve to be tortured or that it's legal to torture them.
Right.
And we don't want them to come out worse than they went in.
Shane, how are you dealing with the consequences of your imprisonment? And what are your, if you could speak to what Sarah was just speaking to, what you're doing?
It's changed over time. It's been about 2.5 years now, and I feel, you know, like I've kind of back to normal, but it was a long process. There was times when I first got out, you know, there was this moment of just incredible joy of being free, and we swam in the ocean in Oman and reconnected with our families and Sarah. And then in the following days, I felt like I was kind of, my mind was in a cloud in some ways. I had a hard time reading people's body language, other than Josh's. I could read every line of Josh's face and, you know, every detail, but other people I had to say to them that I need you to tell me exactly what you mean because I can't, you know, understand the subtleties. I've kind of lost that function to a degree. And it was also really hard for me to make choices, which is really common for prisoners getting out because, you know, you don't really get to make choices in prison, so you lose that function of your brain. And I really, for the long period after that, I carried around kind of a tension that, you know, I now understand as post-traumatic stress. You know, I would just be really on edge a lot and have a hard time being in crowds, sometimes have a hard time being alone, and, you know, just had to kind of white-knuckle it sometimes. You know, would sometimes just feel like I wanted to explode. And I think, you know, it just took time for that to kind of pass and to readjust to being back in the world with people. You know, it takes time to kind of shift out of prison mentality.
Mm-hmm. Right. Josh Vital, your thoughts on this and what we can do. I think we have about a minute left.
Yeah. You know, a lot of my work now, I'm studying history, and I feel like I was caught up in this battle that has decades-old roots, and it's a historical problem between U.S. and Iran. Until we can come to terms with this history of aggression in the U.S. foreign policy, we're going to still find people in situations like that where I lost 2 years of my life.
Wow. Not to mention our domestic policy, the insanity of, you know, having more prisoners than any other country in the world.
Exactly.
Josh, Shane, great to have you all with us. The book is, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The book is A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Let me get my mouse back. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I want to deem the educational system completely dead. The Republicans just came out. Now they're going to sell oil and gas to Ukraine. 2 years ago, we were in dire straits. We were beholden to the Middle East.
We still are.
We didn't have enough oil. Now we're outproducing the rest of the world in oil. We're outproducing in natural gas. And my prices are still the same.
Right.
And going up.
Right.
My gas is going up.
Well, you know why that is, Corky. You've got, you know, Goldman Sachs created this commodities index, and so you've got, you know, according to Bernie Sanders, about a third of the cost of your gasoline is basically money that's been skimmed off the top of the banksters because they're running the futures markets and the commodities markets. And B, the biggest product, the biggest single product that was exported from the United States last year, the year before, and the year before that, was refined petroleum. We refine the oil here. We keep the poison in our air and on our soil, and then we send the gasoline and the diesel fuel overseas to keep our supplies low and keep our prices up.
So we get nothing.
Right.
We get nothing.
Right. We get screwed.
I got one other question to ask you about the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
How come when I take over $9,999 out of the bank, the bank has to report it to the IRS?
Right.
The Koch brothers can take money out of their account and spend it on all these super PACs, and we don't get to know about it.
Right.
Why is that? How is that justice?
Because you're an average working stiff, and the Koch brothers are plutocrats. They're the aristocrats. They, you know, they have people who move their money for them. But you're right. And the other thing is they're not taking it out in cash. I mean, if you go to the bank, if you deposit more than $10,000 into the bank in cash, or if you take more than $10,000 in cash, then that becomes a reportable. And actually, I thought they had dropped that down to $5,000. And this
was. I have to write a check to the car dealer for the car I just bought.
No, that doesn't get reported. That doesn't get reported.
Only if I take it out in cash.
That's correct. This is all about trying to catch people who are playing in the cash economy on the assumption that either they're involved in terrorism or they're involved in drugs or they're involved in something that's not copacetic.
Yeah, well, I still think it's not right.
I
got to report it, they should have to report it.
Yeah. Well, I doubt that the Koch brothers ever even handle cash. They have people who follow them around who handle cash. Or they don't need to handle cash. I mean, you know, it's just they own everything they touch anyway, I would guess.
What is wrong with us? What is wrong with us?
We have lost our way, Corky. We have lost our way. The Supreme Court has given away our country to the plutocrats, to the autocrats. And until we stand up and take it back, it's, you know, this is how it is. This is the new normal. We have achieved what England had achieved during the Victorian era. We have a very small plutocratic class that basically controls the economy and the government. We have a very small middle class that's hanging on by their fingernails. And we have a very large class of working poor people who have basically nothing. 47% of Americans literally have nothing. Their net worth is zero or is negative. And that's America today. It didn't used to be that way. It wasn't that way before Reagan, but it is that way now. Thanks to Reaganomics. Corky, thanks for the call. Minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. That was an interesting conversation. It's astounding when you realize that your own country has 80,000 people in solitary confinement, has more people in prison than any other country in the world, that your own country is one of the greatest violators of human rights, one of the greatest perpetrators of what the United Nations calls torture in the world. And on top of that, that it is a substantial for-profit business doing this. And on top of that, that the Supreme Court has said that those for-profit prison businesses have the constitutional right under the Fourth Amendment and under the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment to buy members of Congress to get themselves more business. This is really and truly mind-boggling. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind? You wanted to talk about Grover Norquist, really?
Yes, I do. I mean, basically, he's still active, and Paul Ryan and Rand Paul and Marco Rubio took pledges to him.
Yeah.
And he has a stranglehold on our tax code right now, and he has had for a long time.
Yeah, since the 80s.
If we run him out of Washington and the people that take pledges to him, we're not going to be able to get a fair tax code.
I don't disagree at all. In fact, I totally agree. The part of the problem is that whenever he's interviewed on national television or stories are written about him, people don't point out that he is A, a multimillionaire, and B, a K Street lobbyist. And everything else is secondary to that. His whole no taxes pledge, all that stuff came out of his work as a lobbyist and out of his being a multimillionaire who doesn't want to pay taxes. And his taking enormous amounts of money from multimillionaires and billionaires as a lobbyist and, you know, as a front man. And he's never described that way. Instead, he's described as a guy who started a nonprofit organization. Well, the nonprofit organization is a lobbying organization. It's like, as long as our media is dishonest with us, we are going to continue to have these kinds of messes, Mark. Thanks a lot for the call. Joan in Chicago, you wanted to talk about racism. Joan in Chicago, listen to WCPT. Joan, you need to listen to your telephone, not your radio. Trevor in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Trevor.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Finally, I waited long enough to be able to talk to you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for waiting. I see 33 minutes here. It's a while. I appreciate it. We had a conversation earlier about this microaggression, about race and racism in the United States.
You talked about microaggression. It's always great to hear you. But everything you've talked about kind of ties in nicely together. So I'll start by describing your surprise that our country's been given away by the Supreme Court to folks that, are oligarchs. It's not a surprise to me as somebody who sees a lot of microaggression. The whole concept of racism started out as a way of pitting us versus them. And when I say us, I'm talking about the white guys who started the country. Racism, you know, in effect came into being when they had to decide who was going to be the haves and who were going to be the have-nots. And they have institutionalized it so much so that even the have-nots continue to make sure it happens. And your previous person did a good job of explaining how people can be tortured in prison in solitary confinement as a result of it.
Right.
It seems, you know, quite normal. So what the Supreme Court did is really a continuation of that. And the surprise to you is because you, white guy, are not used to seeing how people can consider you to have nots and put you in that other category.
You're right.
So my background, I've been very blessed and fortunate. You know, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. And I went to a school with predominantly white people until about second grade. Then I went to public school with a lot of black folks. I went to a historically black college, went to a historically black graduate school, and really got a taste of what the world was like without having to interact with a lot of white folks for my information and my understanding in the world. And it's not until, you know, I was a grown man doing my own thing that I see a lot of people didn't have it as good as me, and I appreciate those times.
Mm-hmm.
And so one important comment I have is that when civil rights, you know, we consider this post-racial and we've won civil rights, I think that a miscalculation of civil rights was integrating into larger society. And please don't take this the wrong way. I don't mean to say that, you know, black people and white people should be separate. but the perspective that I have doesn't come from a value given to me by larger society. It comes from, you know, my own understanding of the world and cultures, despite larger society.
Well, we are resegregating. I mean, this country is resegregating, and I can understand if I was interacting with a group of people who I was continuously being insulted by, I would stop interacting with them.
But after integration, you could, you know, I'll put it like this. I'll give you an example from my family. My grandfather in the 40s in Brooklyn, New York, was what was considered a banker. You know, in common parlance, he would be some kind of gangster. But he was the person that in the neighborhood, he was good with numbers and good with math figures with a third grade education, right, that he could run insurance. You could pay him some money. If you hit the number, you got an extra $500 in your check. And the money that he accumulated from that, if you wanted to open a meat market, you'd come to him and he'd front you the money for the meat market. You want to open a club? Black people in the inner city couldn't get money any other kind of way.
Right.
So he made enough money to send his daughter to college. My mother, she made enough money to be able to send me to college. And we stayed in. There was a separate economy,
right,
an unintegrated economy,
right,
that integration dismantled and took apart so that the value of segregation is taken away. And now any of that value goes towards the integrated whole, which, because of institutionalized racism, you don't even see how it leads.
And this is why black household wealth has gone down in the last 25 years instead of up, in your mind.
Yeah. Precisely, in my mind. And there has been plenty of black people who have made lots of money from the segregated economy that money has evaporated.
Right. I get it. Trevor, thank you for listening to WHMP, and thanks for the call. Very thoughtful and insightful, and I appreciate the ongoing education I get from sharing time with you and all the other folks who are participating with this program. Thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's really a remarkable thing, you know, the state of race in America, the state of prisons in America, the state of our politics, the billionaires. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. Joan in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Joan. Welcome to the program.
Oh, well, hello there, and thank you for having me on your show. I'm sitting there at the website looking at your mom and dad's pictures, and you're so lucky to still have them here.
I have the pictures. My mom and dad are both dead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well, I didn't notice. I just figured that since the pictures were there that you were just sharing them with us. Excuse me for that.
That's quite all right.
Mine's are too, so I know how you feel. But didn't they make us great people?
They did.
Tom, I listened to your show earlier today, and it's hard to turn it away. I heard you with Steve earlier talking about black America and the injustice that's going on in society that I feel will always happen. But I wanted to let you know that I am a black Chicago actress. I am President Clinton's first White House human rights case for people with disabilities in the workplace.
Huh?
My dad, a soldier of the greatest generation, lies in dirt since his death, June 30th, 1993. Well, we buried him in July, but he was offered a White House exception burial on behalf of President Clinton by my constant contact, Susan, the liaison department. I have gone through so much red tape. I have asked my senators, Dick Durbin, Mark Kirk, to do what Senator Jay Rockefeller and John Boehner did in 2011 for their soldier. They went to President Obama. They asked for this soldier. The daughter of the soldier, Frank Buckles, went to the media and said she wanted the highest honor for her dad. I can't get the media to cover my dad of the greatest generation of five battles. And they went straight to President Obama. Her father was buried in 3 weeks' time, and President Obama spoke at his funeral. Now, my dad has been waiting for his burial ever since it was offered. So I had to put him in the ground because, you know, the body will rot. Well, in the meantime, I'm still going through all this red tape with the White House for the treatment of people with disabilities, trying to make things better for them.
Wow.
And the promise was still there to give my dad this burial. Well, in 98, the contact with the White House liaison department just totally stopped. But I'm still saying
This was offered to this black soldier who fought in D-Day, Battle of the Bulge. I have even asked Senator Dick Durbin, well, I already told you about him. I asked Senator Bob Dole, who fought in D-Day and Battle of the Bulge with my dad, to step forward. And I know it's a matter of protocol, but my senators will not even respond. They have my dad's paperwork, but they're not responding when I ask them, why won't you go to President Obama for my dad? Well, now it's gone past President Obama. I'm still asking him to go directly to the Secretary of the Army, who never mentioned my dad's rank befitting a soldier of Normandy, Northern France, the Rhineland, Central Europe, and the Ardennes. He never answered the American Center for Law and Justice wrote a two-page letter telling him what my dad and other Black World War soldiers went through, and that he couldn't honor all soldiers, but to at least honor my dad. Right. Well, President Obama supposedly sent my letter to the Secretary of the Army, and no mention of why he refused to give my dad the barrel that was offered by the White House. No mention of his rank that he earned that World War II denied
Joan,
him.
Joan, I understand you've been wronged. What is? Do you have a and that you wanted to share your story? Do you have a question? Is there anything that
my question is, with the advancement of how we are in technology, why is it that nobody cares enough to say, Mr. President, why haven't you stood up for this man who could not vote, who could not buy a home, and had to sit at the back of the bus and say, yes, sir? If anybody deserves their rank and the barrel offer, it is my dad.
Yeah. Have you, Joan, have you talked with your member of the House of Representatives?
I have talked to everybody. It's gotten to the point where I finally got my dad's medals that he was never given. Now I'm being told, prove you're my father's, you're your father's daughter, when I took this man off life support. Wow. Because my name is not on my dad's birth certificate, I've gone to the Army Board of Review. I have all my dad's papers.
Wow.
But because my dad's name is not on the birth certificate, since I'm an unknown Chicago actress and I don't have the money to get legal representation to have my dad's name put on there, I'm like, this is just another step.
Yeah,
to
Joan,
keep my dad
Joan, it sounds like a very difficult situation. I'm sorry, I can't. I mean, you've just told your story to a lot of people, and maybe somebody from the office of one of those senators at the White House has heard it, and hopefully something will come of it. Have you built a website about this? Is there any any public place where somebody who wants to support you can go? Is there a Facebook page? Is there a
website?
Well,
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Flowers Joan. And if there is a lawyer out there that would like to get my dad's name on my birth certificate, I would love it. Not only that, I'm seeking the...
At Flowers Joan. How do you spell that?
It's my name, F-L-L-W-E-R-S, Joan, J-O-A-N.
Okay,
and
great.
The articles are on Facebook and Twitter.
Okay, great. Joan, I have to move along. I've got a whole long list of people who want to jump into the show here. Thank you for the call, and I wish you the very best. Carl in Chicago. Hey, Charles. Hey, Carl.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Talk about war?
Yeah, you know, I was just watching D-Day on the military channel, and I was thinking about war and what causes wars and how long, you know, what climate usually creates the need for war to correct situations.
Right.
And in the position that we're at right now, the youth in our country couldn't have had it any worse than they've ever had it in the past, as far as trying to get ahead, trying to get an education, trying to earn a living. And there's a lot of capitalism, believe it or not, Alan Greenspan said that our capitalistic system is broken in a book called The Price of Loyalty. You probably heard
Ron Suskind's book. That's where he interviewed Paul O'Neill, saying that the first topic of the first cabinet meeting Bush had was how do we invade Iraq.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we are $17 trillion in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have a guy in Russia, Putin, where it's Russia that used to be the Soviet Union, but no more, not the Soviet Union anymore. Now, there's a similar situation that we have in our country, also is in many countries in Europe, because unfortunately they got hit by the subprime mortgage problem, because a lot of the stuff that should have been rated should not have been rated AAA. They bought not knowing what was going to happen to the stuff when it blew up.
Right.
And that's why a lot of countries, Italy, Spain, their economies were actually crumbled, yeah, because they were buying this stuff thinking that it was quality.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the banksters didn't just rob Americans. They took tens of trillions of dollars from people all over the world. So what's your point?
My point is that if Obama doesn't figure out a way to solve this situation that's going on right now in the Ukraine with the Crimea, and that's used against him in the election, and the Republicans get into power, to me, the climate, the seeds to start a war are perfect, absolutely.
Yeah. I don't disagree. I think that we are closer to a World War I moment than we've ever been. And my prediction as to how this is going to play out with regard to President Obama, although it won't be as vicious as it was in 1992 against Jimmy Carter, or in 1988, I guess it was, or no, 1980, excuse me, when Carter ran against Reagan. But I remember that election of 1980, and they went after Carter saying that he gave away the Panama Canal. Are you old enough to remember that?
Well, sure. And
they're going to say now, you know, Obama gave away Crimea, and it's going to become the rallying cry of the neocons. The difference is that Obama's not running for re-election and Carter was, so it's not going to be as big a deal. But I do agree that we're at a very, very dangerous time, and not just in Ukraine. And I don't think that there is any resolution. I think that the resolution for the Ukraine situation is for us to acknowledge that Crimea is now part of Russia, and just get on with things. And apparently that's not happening now that the G8 has become the G7. And I see this as just a huge mistake. And I hope that we don't make any more. It concerns me tremendously, Carl. Thanks a lot for the call. Alan in Azusa, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, sir. It's actually Alex.
Alex, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I listen to your show often. I very much appreciate it. You know, it's straightforward and it gives me a lot of information. I do want to touch on a little bit on the Native American side and just giving that perspective, because what we're talking about is, like, different perspectives, be it how it is for Americans today, right, as pre-Reagan era, as you were talking earlier. It's kind of like we're living in different worlds on the same land. And the reason I say that is because the myth with America is, like, oh, we came and we, you know, picked ourselves up by our bootstraps and we got everything together and it was just open for us to do that, right, manifest destiny and things of that nature. However, how we look out on the other side, it's like they came and this all happened, and now it's apparent. We're affected today because it's apparent. We live on taken land. And I appreciate you for being open to this discussion, because once we're able to discuss this on an equal level with black people, red people, white people, and all races, all colors, all mixtures.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And this is one of the great amnesias that we have in our history and in our dialogues, is the genocide, the absolute screaming genocide that was committed on this continent in the first three centuries after Europeans first arrived, against Native people. And I'm well said, Alex. Thank you. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And not just the genocide that was committed then, but the ongoing genocide. I mean, look at the levels of crime and early death and problems that we have on our reservation. Welcome back. James in Spring City, Tennessee. Hey, James, you wanted to talk about reverse discrimination?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I listened to all the callers earlier, and I actually went through the process of, I would have to assume a lot of these people that I'd have to deal with were from the region where I live now, Tennessee. And at that time frame, I was living in South Florida, and there were neighborhoods that bracketed mine, and they were of color. And I could see the reverse discrimination in the way we had to deal with our lives.
But how does a black person discriminate against you as a white guy? How do they keep you from having a job?
With an anger.
Well, that's not discrimination. That's just being pissed off. I mean, you know, that's a whole different thing. That discrimination is when you harm another person by preventing them from having the same things that you have available to you. That's discrimination. They're not keeping you out of school. They're not keeping you out of a job. They're not keeping you out of housing.
Good point. But then again,
I mean, and can't you get it where they might be a little PO'd at white people?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I can only embrace the brothers and sisters of this nation. It's pretty messed up.
Well, then the job that white people have is to figure out how to be part of the solution rather than the problem. As much as that's an old cliche, but I mean it's. And it seems to me that Lyndon Johnson made a good start, and then Reagan chopped that thing off. You know, I mean, we had the beginnings of bringing a black underclass into a black middle class, and it was actually incredibly successful. Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in 5 years. And then Reagan came along and started his 1980 campaign was all based on, basically talking to white people and saying, doesn't it upset you when you see a black person on food stamps?
I agree.
So we have to acknowledge that. I think that, frankly, and now you've got Paul Ryan basically saying the same thing. Doesn't it bother you when you see a black man who otherwise should be working, who's not working? And instead, he's living on welfare. And the fact of the matter is that there's no work, and there's no work in part because of insane trade policies. But there's also no work specifically in the black community because the white community has always had it all, and the white community continues to hold on to it. And the white community has and then you do things like affirmative action programs that say, okay, you know, we're going to bring the black community into this. And then you get a bunch of white people running around with lawsuits and things. And this was the University of Michigan case went before the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court, in their infinite wisdom, said, oh, well, there's no more racial discrimination anymore. Or the Voting Rights Act saying, well, no, you know, it's even though they passed the Senate unanimously, you know, they were all afraid of the black people. And that's why they voted that way. I mean, come on, give me a break. We still have a racially segregated and highly discriminatory society where the power is with white people in this country. And until that's addressed, until there's an equal sharing of power, which means wealth, power comes out of money. And until there's an equal sharing of that, we're not going to see the situation resolved. It's not, it is about race, but it's also not about race. It's also about class and status. And how that's enforced along racial lines by white people. James, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. And let's see here. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Yes, I've talked to you for a few years. I've been listening to WCPT for years now. I've never brought up race, even though I've listened to people talk about race. But I'm going to bring it up today. I had the opportunity. I've been here on this planet for a little more than half a century. And I've had the opportunity to observe the Caucasian race. And what I've come to the conclusion is, it's basically three things, conscious, unconscious, and subconscious racism. What I mean by that is you have your conscious racism. That's the person who knows they're racist, who feels like they're superior to everybody, that's not white, and they don't care. Then you have the unconscious. You have those people that racism has been so ingrained into their psyche, into their emotional, psychological makeup, that they're really not conscious of racism even when they exhibit it. And then you have the subconscious racism, which is where the first two comes from. So it's basically from the environment, because each succeeding generation passes down the racism from the previous generation. So it's so ingrained into the psyche of the Caucasian in America that the first thing they have to do is, like you just said to a previous caller, you have to analyze yourself and acknowledge that it's there.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard talk show hosts say things like, well, all people are racist. That's not true. That's a fallacy. I'll give you an example. I grew up down the street from White Sox Park on the south side of Chicago. I got a chance to observe white people from birth, basically from birth, because they're going right past my house every day to go to a baseball game. I went to school with white people most of my whole life. So I've had a very good opportunity to look at white people and observe them and study them, all the while studying my own self. So the thing is, white people have to admit to themselves the wrong that they've done against the Africans from Africa in the United States, but also all over the world, the continent of India, South America, everywhere.
The Native Americans here, too.
Right, Native Americans here, too. So that's the first thing that has to be done, is to admit what your previous generations have done wrong and what the present administrations have done wrong. That's the only way to go forward. And I'll just hang up and listen to it.
Well, don't hang up yet, Wayne, because I'd like to run one thing by you. I get your three categories, and I agree that not everybody is racist, although I think everybody is racially aware. And I think there's a huge difference between the two. But I would add a fourth category, if I could, and speaking as a white guy talking about white people. And that is white people who enjoy white privilege don't understand what it is, or even perhaps do understand what it is, but I think most white people don't understand what white privilege is. And either therefore or without the therefore, do nothing about it. Do nothing about the all the things that are associated with white privilege. And don't engage in the discussion, and don't educate themselves, and don't support political processes that would do something about that. And that's something that is as pestilent, as virulent as racism, that, well, maybe that falls into your unconscious category. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, like I say, for instance, I'll give you an example. I was talking to a white guy right after the Boston Marathon bombings. Now, he wasn't even consciously aware that the reason why those guys did that is because those guys blamed Caucasians for what's happening to Muslims over in the Middle East and other places around the world.
Right.
He couldn't even connect the dots that was a possibility. And the brother who's alive right now came out and said, that's the reason why we did it, because of what the Caucasians are doing to the Muslims. So that's what I mean by unconscious.
Right.
So white people have to make themselves conscious of their past history and their present in order to make things better.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very well said. I agree. Absolutely agree. Wayne, thank you. Thanks for your thanks for calling and sharing that with us. John in Tahunga, California. John, we have a minute until the end of the show. You wanted to talk about Ronald Reagan?
Yes. I do wish to take exception to what you had to say about the transferring everything to the oligarchs in this country.
The Reagan tax cuts in the 1980s transferred $1 trillion from the working people, from the bottom 70% to the top 1%. That's a matter of statistical fact.
I'm not arguing that. What I am arguing is the fact that the oligarchs have been running this country since its inception. Whether you had the manifest destiny nonsense or the medicine nonsense when they were making up the Constitution, or the black slave.
I don't disagree with you, John. I just think it's gotten worse and better and worse and better, and we're in one of those worst phases right now. And the question is, what can we do to make it better when the Supreme Court is making it damn near impossible? John, we should have this conversation in a longer venue. Give us a call back later and we'll get to it. But we're flat out of time here now for the day. So thanks a lot for being with us. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually requires showing up. Even if you're showing up on a website, whether it's movetoamend.org or pdamerica.org or moveon.org or whatever, get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.